This week on the podcast, I have Jeff Graham. He is the author of a really interesting book, of which I will pull out of my bag right now. And the title is Dear Chairman, Boardroom Battles and the Rise of Shareholder Activism. Funny story, those of you who listen to the show regularly know I've had the former SEC chairman, Arthur Levitt, as a guest twice, once just to talk about Arthur Levitt type stuff, and another was a segment dedicated to changes in regulation. They were both really interesting. Anyway, one day I get an email from Arthur, and he writes, I have an interesting young man you should meet. He wrote the book, Dear Chairman. Why does that sound familiar? It turns out two of the guys in my office had already read it. Both of them really liked it. And so I write back to Arthur. Yeah, I'm interested in speaking to him. But full disclosure, you know, in Bailout Nation, I kind of trashed his dad, who happens to be Senator Phil Graham. And I've said stuff about his mom in print. Nothing ad hominem or anything. Just I've written critically about what they've done professionally. And, you know, we really should. Is that okay? Is that going to be a problem? Should we disclose that? And Arthur writes back, that's not going to be a problem. Okay, fine. So instead of sending a separate email, Arthur just replies to that email with my comments to Jeff, copies me, and hey, you guys should get together and talk about the book on Masters in Business. And I kind of do a facepalm. Oh, Arthur, you really don't have the email skills. You should. But anyway, Jeff was a good sport about it. And growing up the son of a senator, it wasn't the first time someone had been critical of his dad. So if you were at all interested in activist investing or the history of value investing, I thought this was a really interesting conversation. So with no further ado, here is my conversation with Jeff Graham.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My guest today is Jeff Graham. Let me give you a little background on Mr. Graham. He is the founder of Bandera Partners, which is a hedge fund located here in New York City. Mm-hmm. He is a graduate of the University of Chicago, got his MBA from Columbia School of Business, where he is currently an adjunct professor. He is also on the boards of several publicly traded companies. He comes from an interesting family. He is the son of Senator Phil Graham and Wendy Graham. And most interestingly to me, he is the author of the book, Dear Chairman, Boardroom Battles and the Rise of Shareholder Activism. Jeff Graham, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, well, that's terrific. Thank you. I enjoyed your book. I'm like halfway through it and really enjoyed it. Several people in my office read it and recommended it. I love the origin story you tell in the very beginning of the book of William Schlensky, mm-hmm. who got two shares of stock in the Chicago Cubs, and that led essentially to the rise of shareholder activism. For people who may not be familiar with the history of the Chicago Cubs, what happened with Mr. Schlensky?
Sure. Well, so Bill Schlensky got two shares in the Cubs as a birthday gift.
How old was he at the time?
I think he was 18 or 19.
Okay.
And he decided, like, look, you know, we've all been enduring these years of terrible baseball. And he thought it, you know, was driven by the fact that they did not have lights on Wrigley Field.
It's, so this is in the 40s?
In the 60s.
60s.
Yeah.
Most of Major League Baseball had moved to night games. They were really popular.
Yeah.
Crosstown rival White Sox were getting quadruple the attendance.
Oh, yeah. They were getting like, you know, 15 to 18,000 people a night.
And 4,000 people were coming to the Cub games.
Yeah, because they're like on a Wednesday afternoon, you know, people have to work.
Right.
And so he thought, well, you know, this is a feeding the poor performance of the Cubs. And he sued them as a shareholder, saying that, you know, you're neglecting your shareholders by refusing to put lights onto Wrigley Field.
So what was the outcome of the suit?
He lost. Basically, the defense of the Wrigleys was that, look, I mean, you know, we care about the shareholders, but we care about the stakeholders too, including the community.
So the business judgment rule basically carried the day.
Yeah. And
which meant that they're not responsible for being correct. It just has to be an exercise of their judgment, right or wrong.
Well, like, and they were very clear that they thought that it would be extremely bad for the neighborhood of Wrigley Field if they put lights on Wrigley Field, and that the board, you know, made the judgment that that was the right thing to do. But in the long run, economics wins.
And eventually they had to light up.
Like the league essentially forced them to put those lights up.
So shareholder activism goes long before the 1960s. You use the example of the Dutch East India Company, and shareholders were angry about self-dealing about the directors. How did that manifest itself?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I think through history, like, you've seen, you know, well, owners meddle.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, you do have this inherent, you know, problem in the system.
The principal agency conflict. So
yeah, exactly.
So you have people running the management, running a business, essentially on behalf of the owners.
Yeah.
And that creates a little bit of conflict for the managers to enrich themselves at the owner's expense.
Well, and when you think about the principal agent problem, in this particular case, it's extremely thorny because the principal are the shareholders, and that's a collective group that often have, you know, differing in, incentives and goals.
Mm-hmm.
And the agent is a board of directors where they're often, you know, they're not that engaged in the business. Like, the information that they get about the business is fed to them by management, you know, so it's a principal and agent problem. And there's also some inherent issues with the principal and the nature of the agent.
So a lot of the letters that you published in the book have never been published before. How, how did you manage to track these things down?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the kind of hook of the book is, it's all case studies.
Mm-hmm.
And each of the cases comes with an original letter. And so for lots of them, I knew the letter existed. Like in the Benjamin Graham chapter, that's the first chapter in the book, he ran a proxy fight against the Northern Pipeline Company. And he had written, you know, there's a whole chapter about that proxy fight in his memoir. And so I knew the letter was out there. It's just a question of trying to find it. And like, I talked to his family and his biographers, and no one had it. And ultimately, I found it at the Rockefeller Archives. But lots of them I just asked. I mean, like, you know, with Warren Buffett, like, I knew from the Snowball that he wrote
the
book, letter.
The Snowball, about Buffett.
Yeah. He famously wrote a letter to American Express in the 1960s. And so I just wrote Buffett, just explained the concept of the book, and can you share the letter? And I got to work one day, and there's an envelope with the letter in it. And,
no kidding.
And
how long did it take for that to get back to you from the request?
Well, weeks. You know, 2 weeks.
There are lots of interesting stories about people making requests about to Buffett, and things magically show up.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. So what motivated you to write this book? What was your drive to put this together?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I love writing, and I've always, you know, thought that that I had like the writing chops to do a book. But really with this one, you know, I'm a full-time fund manager. Like, I didn't have the time. I had two little kids. You know, when I got the letter from Warren Buffett, like, it kind of, you know, turned this idea that I had vaguely had, I'll write to Buffett, like, I'll see if he'll do something. And then all of a sudden, like, I had this pressure of like, well, I have this thing. Like, it kind of burned a hole in my pocket. Like, I got the Buffett letter and the Ross Perot letter, like, within weeks of each other. And, you know,
hard to say no to both those guys.
I mean, the Perot one is a fabulous, you know, letter. It had not been published, and I just thought, well, I have to do this now.
Let's talk a little bit about no relation Ben Graham, spelled with two A's and one M. People think about Ben Graham, and they obviously think about the intelligent investor and value investing and the whole school of thought that comes out of that. But he also turned out to be a bit of an activist investor.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, a lot of the stocks that he bought were exceptionally cheap on a balance sheet basis. And he writes about that, you know, that he likes these, you know, net nets where like the cash and you know, the current assets exceed all the liabilities.
Classic value investing, buy $10 for $8 and
exactly.
You'll do well over the long run.
Yeah. And I mean, ultimately, when you find those situations, like, you know, the market, like, it's not always dumb. Like, a lot of times it has that valuation because of a governance problem.
Mm-hmm.
And very early in his career, he found the Northern Pipeline Company that's in my book, where, like, it was trading in the mid-60s, And he discovered that, you know, they had over $90 per share in liquid bonds.
In other words, they held securities that were worth more on a per share basis.
Yeah, than the whole company.
Sounds a little bit like Yahoo today.
Yep, exactly. And, you know, like with Yahoo, there's a discount because of the tax problem. But there was also in that stock and lots of other stocks, there was a governance discount. And like with Northern Pipeline, he thought, well, this is easy. I'll go explain to this company.
Hey,
like,
you guys,
hey, you
have
all this cash. Just like return it to the shareholders. Like, you know, we'll all retain our ownership in your good company and we'll go from there. And they, you know, they showed him the door.
And let's you say they, the some of the folks who were on the other side of the table included some pretty big names in the history of finance.
Yeah. Well, the company was a part of, you know, like the Standard Oil Company,
which was owned by
you know, the Rockefellers,
small little group that had amassed a couple of dollars and a couple of shares of stock.
Yeah. So when they broke apart, like the monopoly, you know, like they had a whole bunch of public companies. There were eight pipeline companies, and you know, by the 1920s, when Ben Graham began to poke around, all of these things, like, were very overcapitalized, had these boards that, like, were not that engaged. And then their biggest holder is the Rockefeller Foundation, who at the time had a policy, like, to not get involved in the operations of their shareholdings.
But meanwhile, you have this pipeline, Northern Pipeline, trading at 65. So why couldn't Graham just quietly continue to accumulate as much of the 90-plus dollar per share company plus the operating company at 65 and not say anything and assume eventually the market would figure it out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that ultimately he thought that he possibly could do that, but, you know, like the answer there was for them to return that cash, you know? So he quietly bought all that he could until he reached his position limit. And then nothing happened.
What was his position limit?
Well, he was a very diversified investor.
Right. So he's not going to have a concentrated portfolio.
No.
You would think you could raise a fund and just accumulate Northern Pipeline at $65 with $90 in.
Yeah, but exactly. But like it, you know, it never was his MO to like to buy to get control.
So is that why even when things worked out with Northern Pipeline, it really didn't impact his fund all that much?
Well, I mean, it did in the sense it was a big home run. It helped his returns. It taught him about activism and governance, and he did like a lot of activism after that. Like, but ultimately, it was not like the investors that you see today that will have a third of their fund in one stock, and then it's a big home run.
So what was the outcome with the Rockefellers and Northern Pipeline? How did they resolve this? We are an operating company, plus we have $90 per share in marketable securities.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a long saga. So at first, like, they basically told him to go away. He takes the train all the way out, like, you know, to Pittsburgh for the annual meeting. And, like, he tells them that he's, like, prepared a statement. And they tell him, well, you're welcome to come. And he gets up to give the statement. And the chairman asks, you know, would you like to make a motion? And he says, oh, yes, I would like to motion to give my statement. And the chairman asks, well, is anyone here to second that motion? And he didn't bring anyone. And so no one seconded the motion. He had to go all the way back to, to New York. But by doing that, they really made him angry. And so by the next year, he was extremely prepared. He ran a whole proxy fight. He won the proxy fight. He, behind the scenes, through a very good letter that's in my book, he, you know, ultimately convinced the Rockefellers that the right thing to do here was to distribute this cash. And so not only did that happen at the Northern Pipeline Company, but after this episode, the Rockefellers pushed all of the other pipelines to return their excess cash.
So he really had a significant impact on shareholder value and activism.
I mean, I'm not sure, because I do think that all of this was very under the radar. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean,
it wasn't on Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even in the newspaper. Like, it's
the
funny.
Median, there was no financial press that covered this at all.
Yeah. So when I did my book, I looked at all of the old proxy fights. And, you know, there were a few, like, you know, like the Central Leather, like 1911, that like had a very small article.
I love, this by the way, that's none. A fascinating story also. Tell us about the Central Leather story.
Oh, well, just that, like, their whole proxy fight there And this got, well, big news was just for them to disclose information better.
Quarterly release your finances. How amazing is that, that if you went back that far, you go back a century, companies didn't feel obligated to say, by the way, here's how much revenue we have, and here's how much profit we have, and here's what we spent money on. Companies did not even release that.
No, and in the Ben Graham case, it's not clear that the Rockefellers even knew how cash rich the pipeline companies were. And so
that's amazing. You know,
like, it opened their eyes to that.
So Warren Buffett, famously one of Ben Graham's proteges, he had a big impact when he was an activist in the way companies deal with activists and even how they're structured legally. What happened with Buffett?
Well, you know, so Buffett in his early career, I mean, well, first of all, you know, he worked for Ben Graham, and, you know, so he worked at the Graham Newman shop that did lots of proxy fights and did lots of activism. And when he began his own fund in the mid-1950s in Omaha, he also did lots like of buying big stakes in public companies, you know, joining like the boards, and ultimately breaking apart the companies or driving them to, you know, improve profits. And so he did buy lots of these like declining, mature, undervalued businesses. If you look at Berkshire Hathaway, that's effectively what happened there. Like,
right.
It was a terrible, like, declining business, but it was a net-net. He bought control of it, and he ultimately, like, began to use their cash and their declining cash flow to invest in other businesses.
I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Jeff Graham. He is the author of the book, Dear Chairman, which is all about activist investing and how things have changed in the world of corporate governance. He also is an adjunct professor at Columbia University. So you run a fund.
I do.
And you know what it's like to have investors who are looking over your shoulder. How do you deal with that in a concentrated portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, how do I deal with the investors, like, you know, in my fund or like
sure.
in our target companies?
Both. Let's take both first. Do you have your own investors writing you?
Yeah.
Dear Chairman letters?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I think it probably has a lot in common with being a public company CEO in that, like, you have to communicate your strategy, explain to them exactly what you're doing, explain to them how you think about things. And so when things do go wrong, if you have a bad quarter or a bad year, you know, they can understand it. And I think that is ultimately an important job of a public company CEO, too, is like you have to keep your shareholders informed about, you know, how you operate.
You can't guarantee good results, but you can at least say, here's our process, here's what we're doing, and we want you to understand this.
Yeah. And look, I mean, in value investing, like, you're never going to have a great year every year.
That's right. Because by definition, you're buying those stubs, those unloved things, and just because something's cheap doesn't mean it can't get cheaper.
It will get cheaper.
So you wrote yourself a Dear Chairman letter. Tell us about that.
Yeah, my first one, it was... in the early 2000s, at my very first job, you know, which was like the early years of the hedge fund business. And so it was like a little bit of a crazier, you know, more like the Wild West, you know. So the
evolution of that is that today, post 2000, there's 10,000 hedge funds. But for a long time, there was only a handful of funds. There were some pretty well-known guys.
Yeah.
And that exploded around post.com period.
I think it's just a more mature and process-oriented business. I think that when I began in it, I was just out of business school. I didn't know what I was doing. And I wrote a 13D letter to a pretty big public company, the Denny's Corporation.
Uh-huh.
The moons over Miami people. And I just think that back then it was just like, it was a little bit of a crazier time in the business, but they had some problems, and they had tried to kind of expand their lunch and dinner business and had neglected to advertise their breakfast business. It hurt their results.
I think of Denny's and I think of breakfast these
days.
Yeah,
exactly.
So how did you influence that chain? Are you the reason why we have Denny's breakfast all day?
I think I played a role in them not doing a restructuring in the early 2000s. You know, so we basically, it was a cheap stock because it was highly overleveraged.
Mm-hmm.
And you rarely see this as often, but it was a situation where on an enterprise basis, the company was extremely undervalued. You know, where if you could delever it,
Sure.
Like, then you could
get
realize
rid of all
value.
That debt.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, that stuff tends to be a lot more priced in these days.
I would imagine.
You
so
know?
So when you come across a situation these days where there is an undervalued company, the market is mispricing it, and you want management to do something, how do you go about writing that Dear Chairman letter?
Yeah. I mean, in a funny way, even though I wrote a book about it, the age of the Dear Chairman letter is kind of passing. Like, you go mm-hmm. meet with the management, and you meet with the board, and you have a conversation with them, and you meet with the other shareholders. You know, back then, like, you're more trying to persuade the shareholder base. And so at that time, like, the Denny's board was considering doing a restructuring to equitize their debt. And, you know, so we had to...
Highly like, dilutive.
Yeah, you know, so we had to convince the board, no, like, you're doing fine. If you need to raise capital, like, you should do it well, from the stockholders. And by doing that in a public fashion, like, it also got the stockholders behind the idea.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about some of the quotes from the book, and I really like this. In normal market conditions, if I find a good company at cheap valuation, it tends to have governance problems. Is that still true today?
I think that's true, and I mean, that was a statement that I made in the introduction of the book, where, like, I'm kind of explaining who I am and explaining the voice of the book. And, you know, I'm a value investor. I look for cheap stocks, and especially in a market like today's, it's hard to find a cheap stock. And if you do find one, it's often because there's an issue with how they're run.
It's cheap for a reason.
Yeah.
that makes sense. And what's the difference in management at a large company versus a small company when it comes to these governance issues?
I mean, I guess, like, from, you know, from my experience, I generally believe that, like, the larger companies tend to have higher quality boards
mm-hmm.
and they tend to be just like to have higher caliber CEOs and boards of directors. And, you know, that is both intuitive and counterintuitive, because in some ways, like, you would think, well, at these, you know, well, niche small companies, like, you might have these well CEOs, like, who really know the business, you know, but generally the bigger the company, the stronger the board, I think.
All right, let's get back to the activist investor question. And I like the example we talked earlier about Central Leather. J.S. Baish eventually, is that Prudential Baish? Is that where they ended up?
I don't know.
I think that's, if memory serves, I think they eventually mm-hmm. became part of that. They wanted representation on the board merely to get quarterly financial updates to shareholders. That almost seems quaint compared
yeah.
to what takes place today. So what was the result of that bit of shareholder activism?
Well, I mean, in the very early days, activism... I mean, if it was, you know, well, from a financial investors, well, guys like Ben Graham, well, first of all, there was not that much of that.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, it tended to always be about, you know, financial issues, well, financial disclosure or capital allocation. And really, like, you saw a beginning in the 1950s with the Proxeteer movement. That was a very big shareholder activism movement.
In other words, getting actual other shareholders to vote the way the activists wanted
yeah.
in order to force management to do what they wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, in the Proxeteer era, it evolved, you know, to a lot more operating issues and the kind of activism that you see today. I mean, I remember there was in the chapter in the book that's about the proxy fight for the New York Central, the activist even talks about, like, the nature of their passenger trains and like that they needed to build a lightweight train, you know. So things evolved, you know, well, pretty quickly. I'm away from the pure financial activism.
So you raise a really interesting point there, and I'm going to go to a quote from your book. The key issue in an activist campaign often boils down to who will do a better job running the company, a professional management team and their board with little accountability, or a financial investor looking out for his or her own, and I'm going to add the word, short-term interests. So that, to me, that's really a fascinating issue, a fascinating set of opposed interests.
Yeah. And I think in the ideal world, like, you want the activist shareholders, like, well, to be well, long-term oriented, and, like, you do want them all to work together.
Doesn't always happen that way.
No. And lots of times, like, if you're a passive shareholder and there's an activist, like, the activist you know, wants to sell the company.
Right.
And so like you're deciding like who's right here. And,
I like, was, you, I, perfect example was the Carl Icahn activism with Apple. Here's a company on its way to becoming the most valuable company in the world. They dented the universe, to quote Steve Jobs, and invented not one or two, but a number of technologies that were completely innovative, game-changing, altering the landscape. Really, what does a guy who bought a few million shares of Apple have to say about innovation, technology, running a company? I was always very struck at the hubris of, I know how you should be running this company better than you do.
Yeah.
Does that come up frequently with activists or?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like the whole issue is like that ultimately it takes a lot of hubris, like, you know, because as investors, we are working off of extremely limited information. You know, we know less than the board and the management knows about the business often. And so like they do have to have this confidence that like their ideas are right, even when they do tend to have less information. But it's not always black and white. Like, I mean, even in that Carl Icahn case, like on the one hand, like you have the most successful company in history, arguably. Like,
right.
I mean, like they're in...
That's a fair statement.
I mean, they're in a very hard commodity business and they've built, you know, what will right now is like the most viable company in the world. That's an insane achievement.
Not only that, when you look at the mobile smartphone, something that if they didn't invent, they certainly took to a different level, they capture something like 4 out of 5 cents. It used to be 8 out of 9 cents of profit in that space. My favorite stat about Apple is Samsung makes more selling chips to Apple for each phone that Apple sells than they do on their own Galaxy phones.
That's amazing.
Which is their, so for someone to come along and say, all right, nice job, guys, so far, but I'll take it from here. That's really a lot of...
But, I mean, is he clearly wrong? I mean, if you believe in the business will long term, if you believe in the management, like, is he wrong to say, look, you're crazily... I mean, you know, like, you're crazily overcapitalized. Perhaps you should buy back some shares.
Right. It's and unique so, in the history for some company to be sitting... with 200 billion, or at the time, at the time it was 100 billion, now it's 200 billion.
Yeah, and so you know their incentives, like you know that like that Icahn wants the stock to go up, and you know the management probably wants that 200 billion to play with or like to do whatever they want with. Like you as the shareholder, it's not just completely obvious who's right and who's wrong there, and it depends on your like on your long-term view of the company and like your view of the valuation.
We're talking with Jeff Graham, author of Dear Chairman, The History of Activist Investing. So let's look at the current crop of activists. You mentioned Carl Icahn, Warren Buffett, Benjamin Graham, Ross Perot, Dan Loeb. With the notable exception of Warren Buffett, the investors in this book are static characters who undergo little fundamental change. Why is that?
Well, the book is about this activist movement. It's about how we got there. It's about how it happened. And ultimately, an activist is a financial investor, trying to make a profit on their investment in the company. And, you know, like the way that those guys all do it has changed over time, like because of a lot of external factors. But ultimately, at their core, they are still these economic actors out to make a buck. And I think it's important as we look at this history and as like we understand how public companies work, people tend to focus like, a lot on the personalities of the activists and Bill Ackman and David Einhorn. But a lot of the movement that you're seeing now is driven by the behind the scenes passive investors, the people like Vanguard or the big pension funds.
So let's talk about Vanguard because you said something publicly. So for those people who don't know, I think in terms of the United States, Vanguard owns 1 out of every 5 shares of every publicly traded company, which is an insane number. And I heard you on, I saw a video online where you noted that Vanguard has 22 people on staff whose sole job it is to vote the proxies for the companies they own. So we all think of Vanguard as this passive company. But really, if they want to flex their muscles, they're a very powerful player in corporate governance.
Yeah. So, I mean, like the big dynamic that you see in this book is that like the history of activism has been sculpted by like this concentration in institutional investors, like that really began in the 60s with the big pension funds, but then it kind of got kicked into hyperdrive with the index funds and indexation, which is, you know, Vanguard is a pretty old company, but this is a pretty recent phenomenon. I mean, even well, since the financial crisis, like you've seen a dramatic increase in, you know, like in these big, like passive, you know, institutions.
BlackRock, State
like
Street. Quants, it's not just Vanguard. It's a whole run of stuff. That has been at what is BlackRock and Vanguard are each
they're like a huge
$4 trillion
of
dollars. Yeah. Some crazy. You add State Street and one or two more, and that's half the tradable shares out there.
Yeah, and those entities like have basically fallen into the situation like where they are effectively the arbiters of these hedge fund activist disputes. And so like you'll see Bill Ackman in the headlines on you know Canadian Pacific or something, but. Like the people that hold the votes are these big pension funds and Vanguard behind the scenes, and their vote is incredibly important. And so they like are very, they're more engaged than people think in these issues, especially at the bigger cap companies.
Thank you, Jeff, for chatting with us. Can you stick around for the podcast extras? Great. We've been speaking with Jeff Graham. He is the author of Dear Chairman, The History of Activist Investors. Be sure and check out my daily column on BloombergView.com or follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Welcome to the podcast extra. Jeff, thank you so much for doing this. This is really interesting. Before we continue the questions, there's a funny little story I think we should share.
Sure.
So a couple of guys in my office had read Dear Chairman. I keep calling it, by the way, Dear Mr. Chairman.
Lots of people do.
I don't
know
why.
Dear Shareholder. And,
right.
But to me, it's like a pretty snappy title.
Right.
But,
Dear Chairman.
For some reason.
Dear Mr. Chairman. Well, because some of the letters are Dear Mr. Chairman. So Ben Carlson is our head of institutional investing, and he runs that division. And he had done a blog post on this. And then Michael Batnick is my head of research. And he had read the book. Both of them liked it. So I kind of, you know, I have a billion books in my queue and I read whatever is on fire and I have to read. So this was sort of like I knew of it and it was like, oh, that sounds kind of interesting. Maybe I'll get to that. I get an email from none other than Arthur Levitt, former SEC chairman and a previous guest on the show, not once but twice. And he says, I have a young man I'd like you to meet. He wrote this book, Dear Mr. Chairman. And I'm like, why does that sound familiar? Oh, of course, the book. And so I go back and, you know, I respond to, and he mentions, he goes, by the way, he's the son of Phil Graham. And I said, I'm interested in the book. I'd love to speak with Jeff. But truth be told, you know, I wrote Bailout Nation. I was pretty critical of a number of people, Robert Rubin, Bill Clinton, George Bush. But I was pretty hard on your dad, and I wrote to Arthur. I said, I'm happy to talk
to
him.
And my mom.
That's right. I go, full disclosure, I trashed his father pushed the Commodity Future Monetization Act. His name is on Graham Leach Bliley, which repealed Glass-Steagall. And so I said, you know, full disclosure, I've you know been hard on his dad. I called his mom, all sorts of things about Enron and blah, blah, blah. You know, how do you suggest we handle this? Oh, don't worry about it, Arthur says. I'll make the introduction. All right. So I'm like, oh, all right, Arthur might be one of the most charming people.
Yeah,
and
he's great.
One of the finest human beings you'll ever meet. And so he takes that whole email where I lay out the, you know, I've trashed his mom and his dad. Are you sure this is comfortable? And he just replies to me and copies you. And yeah. I see that and I'm like, oh no, Arthur, that is an email faux pas.
Yeah.
And I scroll down and there's nothing bad in the email. It was just, hey, you know, full disclosure, I don't want to, you know, I don't want this person to walk into a room and suddenly feel like he's being sandbagged. You should probably let him know in a subtle way, not just here. Have a look at this. So you were very gracious and said, don't worry about it. I've heard worse.
Yeah. Well, it's a funny situation because I think in like today's world, like you realize like if someone emails you like a chain email, you probably are going to skim that chain.
Of course.
So
Arthur is
so
not
like
the
I skimmed
down,
right. And I'm like, huh? Like, do I pretend I didn't see this? And
well,
so
no.
I just like replied all like, hey, well, none taken.
when I saw the email, it's all right. There's an elephant in the room, and we'll have to address it. And fortunately, you responded to that. It was actually very funny, Arthur. If you're listening, reply all. Not the right thing to. Not the right thing to do, but it was, you know, in the days of Google, whatever you wrote is out there.
Yeah.
I always Google my guests. I don't know if anybody's going to Google me, but if they did, hey, he's written stuff about Senator Graham, and your dad was in the public sphere.
Yeah, I mean, I have
sphere.
A lifetime of enduring that. You know, I mean, he ran for president when I was in college.
Right.
So
how was that?
Yeah, it was a little bit surreal. I don't really remember.
You didn't have
it
a Secret
well.
Service or anything
no,
like that hanging
no.
around.
No, I mean, he got knocked out after Iowa.
Right.
So, but yeah.
Once they become the nominee, the kids are suddenly's lives are turned upside down.
I don't know. I mean, even if you lose, like, do people really know much about, well, Bob Dole's kids or, well, Mitt Romney's kids? I'm not sure they really do.
If you're in college and there's a Secret Service contingency there, I got to think that messes your life up a little. Or it certainly is impactful. It's not going to mess up your life. But suddenly you're going to class and there are four guys with dark glasses and little earbuds in. That's got to be a little surreal.
Yeah. Well, it's been funny. I mean, at that time, like, you know, when you're in college or a kid,
you've grown up with it. It's always been. It's not.
Yeah, like it is like the way it is. Like you're pretty adjustable as it is, and you're kind of completely self-absorbed anyway. So like you don't will have the perspective to understand that like that things are weird. And you know, when I wrote this book, I thought like, well, surely people are going to talk about that. My mom was on the board of Enron.
Right.
And
did that ever come up in any of the reviews?
It has not come up at all.
That's amazing.
I mean, in fact, you know, the connection with my dad has only been mentioned twice, and that is here, like today.
Well, I felt obligated that if I didn't disclose that up front,
sure,
because I never want someone to come in and say, this isn't supposed to be gotcha. You know, this is supposed to be, hey, who are you? What have you done? And how did that come about? That's the thinking here. So that's why I said to Arthur, hey, you know, is he okay with the fact that? I guess Arthur's thought was, well, let's find out. Let's send the email. So Enron has never come up in any of the
book coverage, no.
To be fair, what your parents did in their professional career should not color how someone interprets your work. Your work, the book, at the very least, stands on its own, and it's gotten really good reviews. So I could see both sides. Well, you know, there's a shareholder act. Were there shareholder activists with Enron? I don't ever recall that. It was such a hot stock. It did so well for so long. Was there even a window for activists to jump in on that?
Well, so there were some loud short sellers, right? Well, so Jim Chanos,
right? Not a previous guest,
you know,
but not exactly.
And the journalists were engaged. You know, well, Bethany McLean,
right?
And
also
a
previous guest on the show,
and she's great. And then,
I love her work; she's fabulous.
And then you had like there was an email, like, you know, like an internal, you know, what kind of a dear chairman email, like, you know, which
from who did an internal?
I forget her name.
Dear Ken.
You know, like I want to say Tiffany something, Tiffany Watkins or something, but it was
that
like
familiar.
It was a person
who was
like who worked
junior
in the
CFO
accounting.
Or
something
that
like
sounds
that.
Right.
And like I actually looked at that for inclusion in the book. I mean, I looked at a lot of these. You know, originally the book was just going to be a collection of letters, and not necessarily all shareholder activism, and not all of financial activism. So I looked at like some PETA letters and the gadflies, and I looked at the Enron one, and ultimately
the theme in this works so well. It
yeah, I mean, like the book, like as I narrowed it down,
it must
like,
have
it made
just
a lot
come
of sense,
together
like, to
and oh
way.
Of course this is a coherent package as opposed to a disparate smattering of letters all over the place.
Exactly.
That's the challenge when you're dealing with a lot of different sources. How can I make this thematically consistent as opposed to just, you know, I write about putting together daily lists. I describe it as curate viciously. And you have to do that because there's so many really interesting things that digress you away from, like this conversation. So you ended up deciding it just wasn't worth it to put that in. There
it
was nothing
didn't
as
really
compelling.
Work like, I mean, look, I give her credit, like you know, like for speaking up, but it's kind of a cuckoo, you know, crazy email. Like,
it wasn't like a Loeb letter.
Yeah, I mean,
so speaking of crazy.
Yeah.
we didn't get to the Loeb conversations. Mm-hmm. His letters are poison pen letters.
Yeah, yeah.
They are just dripping with disdain. How effective are these?
Well, I think that was a little bit of a product of the time. So, like you had to put yourself in the late 1990s and the early aughts. Like the hedge fund business it's a new industry. It has not been around that long. It doesn't have a lot of credibility. You've just had
what years are we talking about?
Early 2000s.
Okay.
And
see,
late 90s.
I look at the hedge fund industry as having been around Alfred Winslow
since the late 60s.
Yeah, so it's been, but they were teeny tiny. They were, you know, the joke is there were 100 hedge funds for the 30, 40 years before 2000. And now there's 11,000, but it's those same 100 hedge funds that are creating alpha.
Well, I think about like the beginning of the kind of activist shareholders as more beginning in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what you had there was, you know, like you had a period in the 80s where like these activists had lots of power, like the corporate raiders. They ultimately had cash because of Michael Milken.
Mm-hmm.
And by the 90s and the 2000s, like the activists, you know, they no longer have Michael Milken.
So there's no more the sort of
just the dry powder
leveraged
like available
bias.
To them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so for them to get the attention of the board, you know, that like they tried a whole bunch of different tactics. But, you know, the one that Loeb used was, you know, what I call the shame driven activist.
Uh-huh.
You know, where like he needs to get the attention of the other shareholders, of the board of directors, and of the management team, and he did it through town hangings and public shamings. And
is that an effective technique? Does it work?
I think it worked then because it got people's attention. It gave him a reputation that directors would be like afraid of, but ultimately like it also compels the management to circle their wagons. And well, nowadays it's not necessary because activism, from hedge funds is credible. And so what you will really need to do is convince the Vanguards and the CalPERS of the world that like that your ideas are right. And doing that, well. Is not about, you know, we're calling out the CEO's mom, you know, so.
Which Loeb did in one notable letter, basically saying something along the lines of, I think the final line was, I doubt if you ignore this letter that your mom is going to fire you, or words to that effect, which are pretty scathing. So, I'm pulling one of these statements, the Stark Gas Partners.
Mm-hmm.
This is just great. Sadly, your ineptitude is not limited to your failure to communicate with bond and unit holders. A review of your record reveals years of value destruction and strategic blunders, which have led us to dub you one of the most dangerous and incompetent executives in America. That's not enough. He has to keep going. And he says, I was amused to learn in the course of our investigation that at Cornell University, there is an IRIC 7 scholarship. That's who the letter was to, IRIC 7, president and CEO of Star Gas Partners. One can only pity the poor student who suffers the indignity of attaching your name to his academic record. So how typical or atypical is that sort of viciousness for Loeb and for other investors? Are his poison pen letters unique to him, or have other people adapted that?
Well, at that time, there were lots of them, and he was not even the first one. Like, the first guy, like, that really did that was, like, this crazy guy named Bob Chapman. And, at that time, it worked, like, because, you know, well, no one else was paying attention to these hedge funds.
Like, had to be shocking to get a letter like that.
You know, I mean, you know, they didn't have the capital to just like to buy enough shares to replace.
You get
the
to 5%, you're immediately you're filing and you're doing all these things that. That's usually with a big company, that's a chunk of money.
Yeah. But Dan Loeb, you know, well, nowadays, first of all, I mean, he doesn't even do that much activism.
Mm-hmm.
And when he does it, like, he'll still do a public letter, but like, he knows that, that he needs to build consensus, like, among the big institutions. Like, mm-hmm. it's just, well, not the way that things in the 1990s were. And, you know, that was more a product of those times.
Makes a lot of sense. So let's go through some questions we missed.
Mm-hmm.
And there were two in particular that I wanted to make sure we got to. Let's start with the second first. Activist investors now have much more power than they used to and the ability to affect change in ways that they couldn't do in the past or that were more difficult in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So discuss that. How has the role of and the authority and power of activists changed over the past few decades?
Sure. Well, you had a period, you know, from the 60s until the 80s where, you know, a share ownership in the country had reconcentrated, you know, but into the hands of these big institutions. And the big institutions were not that engaged. You know, they were not, that involved.
We're talking foundations, endowments, pensions, big institutional investors.
The big mutual funds, the big mm-hmm. pension funds. And there's a real turning point in the 1980s because, like, you have the corporate raiders.
So Milken funding a lot of these people.
Like, you have Greenmail, mm-hmm. which was pretty blatant in its, mistreatment of public shareholders. Like, if you're, a company and you buy out like a loud and troublesome shareholder for a big premium over everyone else just to make them go away, you're clearly disservicing your shareholders.
Sure.
And then you had Ross Perot happen. And with Ross Perot, GM like is undergoing, a few decades of decline. It's very public, everyone knows that they're beginning to fall behind the Japanese. And their shareholder base are these big institutions that have been in GM forever, and they see GM pay Ross Perot $750 million.
That's a lot of money for GM.
Yeah, to resign from the board of directors. And so they're paying this guy who they view as the most engaged and best director to leave.
Go away, kid, you bother me.
Yeah.
That was it.
And it kind of showed them, well, we have created a monster.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point on, the big institutions began to get engaged, and they began to like to pay attention. They began like to vote their proxies with a lot more thought, and that has in a funny way, it's empowered these activists, because if you do have ideas that resonate with investors, or like if you want to push for a CEO to be fired, and the people like at CalPERS, well, maybe they're not as comfortable, publicly I'm asking for someone to be fired, but well, maybe they think that they need to go. They support a lot of these activist campaigns, and so this empowerment of the activist, a lot of that is about the resolve of the big passive institutions.
That's interesting. So let's talk about different sectors of companies. One of the things I asked you about earlier. Off mic, I want to bring up on mic. So you have tech companies, and then you have like a big consumer products company like Colgate-Palmolive.
Mm-hmm.
Are there differences in how activists approach those two companies? And conversely, how do those two sectors, a tech company and a consumer goods sector, how do their CEOs and boards respond to activists differently?
Yeah, I think that ultimately, fundamentally, like they're all very similar. Like
mm-hmm.
they're companies, and they often have governance issues, and like you have to decide who is like the right person to lead this company. And you'll see people say like, oh, well, this is a complicated high technology company, and so like you really need to be sophisticated so activists have no place there. And that's just clearly not right. I mean, if it's a highly, you know, complicated company, then like it matters who the CEO is, and like it matters that like you don't will tolerate bad governance for long periods of time. And then like you'll see people say, oh, well, Colgate or Coca-Cola, they're these like mature businesses that can run themselves. Like, who cares about the board? Like a monkey could run the company. And that's also clearly not true, because with a mature business, like, you have to allocate the capital.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have to decide what to do with your excess cash, if you will pay a dividend or buy back shares or pursue opportunities in M&A. And so all of those...
And that's before we start looking at a competitive threat from new companies,
totally.
From existing companies.
Look, and I think that like the history has shown that as secure as you think you are, if, you know, when you look at GM in the 1950s and you say this is a durable competitive advantage, they have a cost advantage, they have a dealer network, they have the best brands. And in two decades, they lose out to the Japanese, who like have no capital, have terrible brand, a reputation.
Sure.
And like they have no dealer networks. And, you know, so, I mean, even a mature, great business, as we've seen in Coca-Cola, can come upon hard times.
I think this is the first year where bottled water is going to outsell soda. And so if you're not, there's always competitive threats. Andy Grove said only the paranoid survive. And he's right. If you don't think your business is going to be attacked in the competition in the marketplace, you're kidding yourself.
Yeah.
So let me turn the dial a little bit and shift the focus. So you go through all these activists, you go through all these businesses, you look at how all this stuff has changed. How has this impacted your thinking about how you invest your capital? I don't mean you as a manager getting a Dear Chairman letter. I mean, what has been the impact of this on your thought process in terms of putting risk capital out there?
Yeah, I mean, it gave me historical perspective, like a lot of the history I didn't know. But, you know, I think investors learn best from losing money.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of had lost enough, money through bad governance, like to learn the lessons of the book. Like I think, lots of the value of the book is explaining how the system works and how we got to now. And, you know, we're trying to do it in an entertaining way. And I think a lot of the things that I fundamentally learned were like about just like the power of these like behind the scenes passive investors. But in terms of affecting, you know, my personal investments, you know, in value investing, you do have to take into account the governance. But I had already, learned the hard way about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure it's affected it that much.
So what attracted you to value investing in the first place, other than Columbia? That's where Ben Graham taught, right? I mean, is it safe to say Columbia Graduate School of Business is square one when it comes to value investing?
You know, they like to say that, and it was true for me. And I mean, I after college, I played music, and I had no business background. I didn't know accounting. Like, I had never heard of Warren Buffett. And so when I got to Columbia, I didn't know what I was going to do. I took a lot of different classes, and I took a class with Joel Greenblatt.
Sure.
And
the little book that beats the market.
And before that, he wrote a book called You Can Be a Stock Market Genius.
Yes.
That's about, you know, restructurings and spinoffs. I think the subtitle is like uncovering the secret hiding places of, you know,
of value.
And I think that, that I like had never heard of that stuff, and the whole idea of buying a 50-cent dollar, it really resonated like with me. And so I began just to consume everything I could, and that of course led me to Warren Buffett, and that is how I got into it.
I'm gonna pull up the exact quote. You can be a stock market genius uncovering the secret hiding places of stock market profits. And that came out in 1999. That book has really been around for a while and stood the test of time. So I've plowed through a lot of questions. Let's go into our standard questions that I ask all my guests.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned you were playing music. What did you tell us a little bit about your background? What did you do before finance?
So I played in a rock band.
Mm-hmm. What'd you play?
A guitar.
Okay.
And
so
I
that
sang.
Makes you our third guitarist guest.
All right.
Because I've had Lawrence Juber and before that John Pizzarelli, and we have another guitarist coming up next month. I'll leave that for a surprise. So you're number three.
Uh-huh.
How long did you do that for?
Pretty much through college. Like mm-hmm. I think. Like I kind of in college, we majored in being in a band, and then I graduated in '96, and pretty much from then until I went to business school in 2001, I toured, and then when I was not on tour, I temped. I lived in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting to come to New York because people in bands in New York have, real professions and actually,
right.
Will have real jobs. But in every other city, like you're a bartender or a temp or like
uh-huh.
work at a restaurant. And so like I toured and temped.
That sounds interesting. Jeff Gundlach was a drummer.
Oh, really?
Before he became a Bond guru. And it's always interesting to see how people find their way. So. You're playing rock and roll music, you're touring. What made you say, listen, I enjoy life on the road, but I really want to get an MBA? How did that come about?
Well, like we really weren't that successful.
Okay.
Right? Like we kind of we did well in the sense like that other bands liked us.
What was the name of your band?
It was called Aiden.
Spell that.
A-I-D-E-N.
Okay. Oh, sure.
And we ultimately just weren't that good.
Uh-huh.
And the other band, the other band members, like, were kind of like beginning to think about the future too. And I remember I was in DC and I met with Arthur Levitt. He was a friend of my dad's, and I tried to think about, what would be a versatile degree that would allow me to at least discover something that I would be good at.
So I'm looking at, for those of you who want to go to Amazon and check this out, how many CDs did you record?
We had four.
All right.
So we had...
I'm seeing Hey 19, which sounds like the Steely Dan song.
Yeah, that's our third record.
Black Cow.
Yeah.
Also a Steely Dan song.
That is also a Steely Dan song.
Topsiders.
I think that's our best record.
Really?
Is that Topsiders?
2002, or is that the reissue in 2002?
I think it came out in 01.
Okay.
But that one was like the death of the band. That was where we that was a grim tour.
Steely Dan titles?
I don't know. We liked them and
what's
not
to like about the Dan?
And they were very untrendy at that time. This was this was before the reemergence of yacht rock.
Okay, because I'm older than you. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school or maybe college, Gaucho came out and Asia was inescapable on the radio.
Of course.
But a lot of their stuff has really stood the test of time. If you like rock and you like jazz,
mm-hmm.
there's an argument to when we've had these debates, and there's a whole post somewhere on the blog if you look at who is the greatest American rock and roll band.
Mm-hmm.
So by saying American, you're eliminating the Beatles, the Stones, the Who. And by saying band, you're eliminating Bruce Springsteen and other people who we really think of as solo artists, not bands.
Mm-hmm.
Steely Dan always makes the top five.
That's interesting.
And you don't really. I'll send you that link. I'll post it when this goes up. But that's interesting. You guys really put out music, and we're regular, actual touring musicians.
Yeah, and being in a touring band is an incredible experience. It really teaches you to get along with people, and
mm-hmm.
it teaches you a lot. Being in a small vehicle with four people.
You're in a van touring going club to club.
Yeah, we do 32 shows in 31 days, like that kind of thing.
Right, and you gotta hope the thing doesn't break down and go flat.
And like you really like learn about like your own emotional buildup.
Sure.
Because if you're too uptight or you're too tense, it can be pretty miserable, you know? So like, I think it made all of us just like relax like a little bit. And I think that it was like, I mean, we're all, you know, doing well professionally. And I think it was a valuable experience.
Huh. That's quite fascinating. I know Gunlock played in a hair band, in a hair metal band.
Awesome.
And I'm trying to think. There's one other person who was also a musician. It'll pop into my head. So you mentioned Arthur Levitt.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit about some of your mentors, and you can include Arthur in that list.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Arthur is the main one. I mean, I think he really helped me get into business school in the first place. And then, like, he's just been, you know, so supportive of my career, and he's been very supportive of this book. And you know, I mean, I think Arthur is the son of a politician.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that
his father was New York State comptroller, if memory serves.
Yeah.
And actually one of the longest running comptrollers in history. And I think Arthur might have been one of the longest running SEC chairman.
I think that he is the longest running one. Yeah.
So he knew you could relate to somebody who.
Yeah. Like I think
growing up
think
under
could,
the shadow
like,
of,
yeah.
of a famous father, that can't be the easiest thing in the world to deal with.
Yeah. And then, well, professionally, I mean. Like that Joel Greenblatt class was very like important for me. And then at my first job, like I worked at kind of a dysfunctional hedge fund, but I had the director of research at that job was this guy named Greg Schrock.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a Wachtell Lipton lawyer in the early 80s. And
lots of M&A experience.
Yeah, he just knew so much and like was always, you know, really took the time to kind of what to show me like the right things like to read and like to ask the right, you know, questions about public companies.
Hmm.
So, I think he was a big fan of your blog.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a small world. Every now and then someone out of the blue will say that to me and I don't know how to, I won't mention his name. But a household name one day says to me, oh, I'm a fan of the blog. I've been reading it for years. And I just responded with an expletive. BS. And he's like, no, really, my son read it. He turned me on to it years ago. I read it every morning. And it's just such a weird. So when you are somewhat quasi public, it's really startling. Do you ever have an experience where someone knows you because of your dad and talks to you like they know you
not in years. I mean, I think he's just, you know, more under the radar now.
He retired.
But, like, for sure, when we were doing the touring stuff, like, you sometimes, like, we'd be playing in, like, you know, Jackson, Mississippi or something, and there'd be this, like, contingent of young Republicans there.
Would show up to the
band. Which would be totally baffling.
Right.
So that occasionally happened, but not that much.
And that's really interesting. So you talk about so many different investors in the book. Ben Graham, Warren Buffett, obviously. What other investors influenced your investing, your thought process?
I mean, I do think for me, it really kind of all boils back to Buffett.
Mm-hmm.
Like he kind of covers all the bases with his writing. I read all the Munger speeches. Like I read all of the Seth Klarman stuff.
Uh huh.
You know, so like when Klarman has an article or a speech. But
I actually just put a Klarman video up on the blog over the weekend.
Well, you got to get him on the show.
He's kind of a recluse. He doesn't do a lot of video, a lot of media, even though this is not the typical media. But feel free to make an introduction.
I don't know him, but he seems very funny. Like I've seen him in these fireside chats, or I've seen him, you know, give talks, and he's engaging and funny.
All right, so we'll reach out to Seth if you're listening. We'd love to have you. We'd love to have you on the show because, you know, 90 minutes in, you know, Seth Klarman is hanging on every word. Let's talk about books.
Mm-hmm.
What books have you enjoyed, be they investing or non-investing, fiction or nonfiction? What books have really influenced you?
Okay. Well, I'll begin with the business ones. I mean, I do love business books. I've, you know, doing this book, I got to read, you know, so many incredible business books. You know, just if you look at GM, Like the library of of incredible books about GM is just incredible. There's like the Alfred Sloan book, My Years with General Motors. And if you read that.
That's pretty old, right? That's 50s
yeah,
or something like that?
I think 60s. And then if you read that alongside the John DeLorean book about the decline of GM, you know, from a distance, you on a clear day, you can see General Motors. Like if you read those two books and the chapter in Peter Drucker's Adventures of a Bystander about a Sloan, that's incredible reading. You know, like I like journalistic business books. Like I loved all of the late 80s. You know, corporate raider books like A Predator's Ball, A Den of Thieves. I obviously love Michael Lewis. I assume that everyone...
That's just a default given.
It's like you need to begin to ask, like, what's your favorite Michael Lewis book as opposed to
author? I often tell people, I know you've read Flash Boys and The Big Short and Moneyball, but have you read a new thing? Because a lot of people skip that. It's a really, really good book.
Yeah, I think in a like in a funny way, at the time that was among his a better received books. You know, because
I don't think it is as popular as some of the other ones.
Yeah, I mean, but you know, he had had Liar's Poker, which was great, and then that made a splash like on the release, like the new thing did. You know, I love Boomerang. I think that's my favorite one of his. That's his collection of Vanity Fair.
Right. It's just, I love the story of him going to the Greek monastery. Right. How astonishing is that tale?
That whole thing. I mean, I remember in the Germany chapter, I was crying tears. You know, so I mean, you know, I love that kind of writing. The Tracy Kidder, you know, Michael Lewis. I loved.
What's the Tracy Kidder book?
Well, so he did Soul of a New Machine, right? So, you know, that was like among his first book. He's like among like the first like of these like immersion journalist types. So I think my favorite of his is a recent one, Mountains Beyond Mountains. It's about a Paul Farmer, the Doctors Without Borders guy. But he did House, Hometown. I mean, he's a fantastic writer.
It sounds like you've worked your way through the whole genre. I wrote
incredible.
All three down. Anybody else stand out?
I would say, you know, like when young people come to talk to me about value investing, I'm always shocked when they have not read The Snowball. You know, they'll have read the Lowenstein book, which is great. They'll like have read. Like,
which was one of the first, Lowenstein tells us, so he was a guest on the show. He tells a story that he went to Buffett about having access in order to do the book. And Buffett says, you're probably better off without access and hearing what other people have to say instead of me telling the story. And he said it was good advice. The book turned out to be much better otherwise.
Yeah, it's a great book.
Making
but,
of a Capitalist, is that
yeah.
right?
You know, or the making of a modern
right.
of an American capitalist. But The Snowball has the access, and the access is incredibly valuable. And it blows my mind that these, you know, young kids who are obsessed with Buffett have not read that book. I think it's a shame that, like, that book is not, like, as popular as it should be.
The Making of an American Capitalist. Well, I mean, it's 5-star reviews, and it was extremely well reviewed. I thought it sold pretty well, but certainly nothing like When Genius Failed, which was his.
Well, I'm talking about the Snowball is the.
Oh, okay.
Was
gotcha.
The big
yeah.
one, you know, I, like I the Alice know. Schroeder.
How did Snowball sell?
I think it did well, but I think like they were kind of banking on Buffett supporting it, and like he ultimately like withdrew his like you know his involvement. And
Alice Schroeder has been working with him for forever, right? She's
yeah, but I think at some point like they had a falling out, and you know, I mean, it's funny. So this year, like I go to the Berkshire Hathaway meeting every year, but this
oh, really?
Year, but it was the first time that I did the book thing, and there's all these book events, and that book was invisible at that meeting.
Really?
Yeah,
and I didn't know that. I didn't know they had a falling out. I thought
yeah,
and
it's the best one. It's just just there like are some vignettes and they're like, you know, when like the Solomon board will tries like to tell Charlie Munger like about like the things that like that they've uncovered, and he let you know like immediately will sees through all the BS and begins like to ask all the who talked to whom, will win, you know, who did you know. It just, I mean, all of these inside stories in that book are incredible.
In Snowball.
Yeah.
I actually have not read that.
You got to read it.
I'm going to put that on my list. You mentioned Munger. Have you read Poor Charlie's Almanac?
I have. It's great.
It's on my night to have at home. It's a tome. I'm slowly working my
Way you just got to read the speeches, you know? But it's funny. I mean, I love that stuff, but I do think that sometimes, you know, well, from an investing perspective, like that we as an industry overdo like the kind of thinking clearly stuff. I think it's important for individual investors like to understand the nature of misjudgment and psychological bias, but at the same time I think like that we as an industry have like perpetrated this idea that if I pick stocks that I'm like that it's like a game of wits and I'm like the wiser guy than the person on the other side of the trade. And like, to me, the longer that you do it, the more that you realize that you're just trying to not make mistakes and to do your homework.
Charlie Ellis, unforced errors are what kills most investors. Any other books before we go on to some more questions? I mean, I could talk books for hours.
Yeah. I mean, I really love, pop science books and I love music books. Yeah,
so give me one of each.
Okay. So there's two great music books, Please Kill Me, which is like an oral history of punk rock. And then The Motley Crue, a memoir, written by Neil Strauss, is incredible. Pop science. I love.
Wait, before you move beyond music, I have a few books to ask you some questions.
Sure.
So David Byrne's Musicology.
Read it.
You should read it.
I know.
It's really
I'm behind now because of
writing the book.
Of doing my book.
Writing a book puts you behind.
Yeah, like the Patti Smith I haven't read. I haven't read the David Byrne.
I haven't read Chrissy Hynde's. It's not on the night table. It's on the dresser, which is the next pile. The other book that's really kind of interesting, it sort of predates you a little bit, is Nick Hornby, High Fidelity.
Yeah.
If you've never read that, it's...
Yeah, nope, I have.
Oh, it's you great. Have? It's fantastic, right?
And it's actually in the movie, my band has a poster in their record store.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
At the time, it was extremely exciting.
We're
making it big. Our poster's in this movie.
First of all, I love that movie.
It's
for
great.
countless reasons, not the least of which is when... You finally get to the end, and Jack Black takes the stage.
Yeah,
everybody's head exploded at that point. but I read the book years before, and reluctantly went to the film because you know what it's like when you read a book and then the movie is terrible, and then the movie is different enough that you could see they're trying for something else, but it's true enough to the attitude.
Yeah, no, they both work.
Yeah, yeah, it really, really. Two recommendations: High Fidelity, the book, and High Fidelity. The movies. So let's go to popular science.
Like, I love like the journalistic ones where they get out. So like there's a book called this The Song of the Dodo.
Okay.
And it's about extinctions and extinction on
Dodo.
Extinction on islands.
Uh-huh.
And it's just like it's a really fun book. Like he travels like the world and he goes to all these islands and
Many years ago, I read Douglas Adams' Last Chance to See.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
same thing.
I haven't read that, but
so you read. So he just goes around and looking at these creatures that are on the verge of extinction, and some of whom, between the time he visited and the book came out, he said, "Oh, and since then, you can't see this because it's."
Yeah, I mean, I always thought like that. Well, one day I would take some time from work and do a science book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but then I had a book idea about something that I knew about, so like you know,
and
it
that,
made much more sense to
write what you
chairman.
Know. That's the classic. Give me one more science book.
I like The Beak of the Finch. That's also
out there. Sure.
Yeah, it's a little bit of like an inside account of these, academic researchers in the Galapagos.
And sure.
It gives you a feel like these people have devoted their lives. Like they go back to the Galapagos every summer for 30 years.
Which is amazing,
and it gives you a feel for kind of like how you know, what committed you would have to be to be a scientist.
It's insane. So sounds to me like you're one of them newfangled evolutionaries.
Well, I do like all those, like the Stephen Jay Gould books. And mm-hmm. like as a kid, I loved Darwin, all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I mean, like the idea that even if you don't believe in Darwin, the book is just like to read the book and to see like his reasoning. It's an incredible learning experience. So, how can you not teach it even if it's wrong?
It's so compelling. I don't know. I found it hard to get through that book and say, oh, all of this stuff is made up.
Yeah. It's got that magical thing that some books have where like you read it and after like you read it, it just seems obvious.
That's right? Always the tell of a really brilliant idea is that how your hindsight bias after the fact is always,
totally.
Well, of course we believe this beforehand.
It's like I intuitively know this, obviously.
There's a wonderful book if you want to look into, so this is all biology, if you want to look at the physics side, mm-hmm. James Gleick did a book called Chaos. And after you finish that, you're like, oh, of course. How else could you have looked at this? When going into it, you had no idea on the science of chaos theory as applied to physics. You couldn't in a million years have imagined that. And then afterwards, it's like, oh, of course. It's that same sort of magic. So let's talk a little bit about things. I think we've covered books pretty well, right? before I move on. Let's talk a little bit about what's changed since you've joined the hedge fund industry. You've been doing this for more than a decade and change.
Mm-hmm.
How have things changed on that side of the street since the early 2000s?
Sure. Well, in some sense, I'm not the right guy to ask because I work at a small fund that's on the fringes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to the extent I've seen things change, they've gotten a lot more mature, a lot more institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
As we talked about on the radio segment, like when I got my, you know, first job in the industry, anyone on the trading desk, if they had an idea, like it could go in the portfolio and you could write 13 Ds and it was just a crazy time. And now it's a lot more institutionalized and, you know, with that comes, I think, a lot of good things. Like, I assume, risk controls are, are way better. I assume the blow-ups are less pedestrian. But then there's also, it's just, you see this, a pedigree matters now in this way that, like it didn't before. If, you came out of a good shop, then it's
makes a difference.
Yeah, and so you know, that kind of thing is happening now.
You see that on the quant side as well. There's a lot of what's your...
Yeah, well, you came from Renaissance, so, you're going to be good at this. In our business, it's a lot about how hard you work. There's not lots of a special sauce, you know? Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. So so we're down to our last two questions. These are my two favorite questions I ask all of my guests.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned occasionally you have millennials come to you. What sort of advice would you give to a millennial or someone just starting their career and said to you, I'm interested in the career of finance? How would you answer that question?
Yeah, well, for the millennials, and my students, the first thing I say is all of the cliches about we'll get to work first, and hard work are totally true.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're
you'd
cliches
be surprised,
for a reason.
And you'd be surprised at, how few people act on them.
Oh, really?
I think so. I tell people, that ultimately you're a smart kid and you have good judgment. And your judgment over time will develop. But at these early jobs and as you learn the business, you're really being paid to do work, to learn to do research. You're not being paid to be wise. And I think
that's interesting.
One thing that I see a lot in my students is, they want to sit and think big thoughts about a company.
Uh-huh.
They're less inclined to do the hard work it takes to find the expert that's out there that can really explain it to you. And that's the way that our business works.
You have to pay your dues.
Yeah,
for some time.
You're doing work to find the experts. Like you don't just like lean back in your chair and say, I'm gonna outwit the whole market. And so like I really try to tell them, it's less about your, you know, wisdom, like in judgment than you think. And at your first job, you're gonna be paid to do hard work.
You're the grunt when you're starting out.
Yeah.
You're doing, and that's pretty much true in every profession.
Yeah.
You start out as a lawyer, you're doing the grunt work in the library. It's miserable. Who wants to bill 3,000 hours a year? And finance is not all that different.
Yeah, specifically in terms of a finance, I don't give a lot of advice on if it's the right job or only they know that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously investing is extremely fun and it's a great job, but I do think they need to be in it because they like doing it. I mean,
if you go in it just for the money, you're going to be sadly disappointed.
I'm sure that you've seen this where I talked to someone, well, not that long ago, that was like an undergraduate that was extremely into biology.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, they had this whole idea of like, well, I'm going to get like a master's in this. Like, I'm not going to get a PhD because, you know, what I want to do is advise either funds or investment, you know, bankers on biotech stuff. So I'm like, well, why do you want to do that? You know, why would you want to be an investment banker for biotech? He's like, well, like, you know,
lucrative.
Yeah, well, you can make a lot of money. And I was like, that's like, what are you thinking? If you're like a 19-year-old and you love science, like before deciding to be an investment banker, like, well, maybe you should pursue science. So like, you got to be in
good advice.
It's like, you got to be in it for the right reasons, I think.
I think that is very astute, and you can hardly go wrong telling people if you follow your passion, it's going to take you to the right place. But if you do this for the money, may not work out so well.
Yeah, I hope that's true. I mean, what do we know?
I think that's true. And what you said is fairly consistent with lots of what our guests have said,
mm-hmm.
is if you're just doing something for the money, it's a job, it's a labor. And when you do something because you really are passionate about it, you love it, the money will come eventually and you won't be miserable.
Mm-hmm.
Having the money being miserable and then making a decision to shift 20 years later is a much bigger challenge than gradually ramping up the cash. And our last question, what is it that you know about value investing, activist investing, and others that you wish you knew 15 years ago when you were just getting out of school?
I think it's probably that same point of like, I think that back then I bought into this idea like of, you know, well, I'm going to outwit the market. As opposed to the idea of like, I'm gonna like do a lot of hard work and we'll try not like to make too many dumb mistakes. And I think that like in investing, it's a lot about just avoiding the disasters.
Jeff, thank you so much. This has been terrific. I appreciate you being so generous with your time. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure and look up an inch or down an inch on Apple iTunes, and you can see any of the other 100-plus conversations we've had. I would be remiss if I did not thank my booker, Taylor Riggs, Charlie Vollmer, who is, I guess, technically our producer when he's not busy blowing up things in his kitchen accidentally, and Michael Batnick, who is our head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.